Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs to order. It's 3:02 p.m. Tuesday, February 18, 2020. We're in the Max Grunberg Room. Martha, will you please call the roll?
Representative Story?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Here.
Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Shaw? Representative
Hunter? Here.
Here, with 6 of 7 members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. We're joined by Senator Bishop. Reminder, everybody, please silence your cell phones. Thank you, Martha, for maintaining records, and Madison in the back for playing air traffic control on testimony over the phone. We have 3 items on today's agenda. The first item is Senate Bill 144, sponsored by Senator Bishop, establishing June 7 as Walter Harper Day. It's the first hearing of State Affairs. The second item on today's agenda is House Bill 74, which is the Ocean Pollution Monitors, Ocean Rangers, DEC, cruise ship extravaganza. And then the third item on today's agenda is House Bill 239, establishing a state lottery, sponsored by Representative Thompson. That's also a first hearing. We'll start with Senate Bill 144. Welcome, Senator Bishop, to the or Mr. Peterson, staff to the senator. To the House. Congratulations on passage in the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thanks for the warm welcome. At your direction, I'm ready to launch when you say go.
Yeah, please do, Senator Bishop.
All right, thank you. Today before you is Senate Bill 144, Walter Harper Day, and I'm just going to speak from the heart, and my Chief of Staff, Darwin Peterson, has done a yeoman's job on a very analytical overview of Walter Harper. And I'm just going to bring it from the heart, and then we'll let him talk about the detail. But this goes back, it's kind of personal for me. I'm a history student of history in Alaska history especially. And if you remember the names Harper, McQuesten, and Captain Mayo, those three men are responsible, written in the annals of history, of opening up Alaska, the Klondike, and the discoveries of gold in the Yukon and Alaska. So his father, Arthur Harper, Walter's father, I happened to used to drive boats past Harper's Bend on the Tanana River, right above the village of Tanana. There's a big bend in the river, and it says Harper's Bend. You know, and as a young kid, you learn all your routes along the river, and get a little older, and you start reading more than reading the history and the significance of that. And then to June 7th, his son Walter Harper. So that's the day they summited Denali. To do it in the fashion that they did it was just nothing short of bird going to the pole. It's that, you know, they didn't have REI to go to and shop, and they didn't have Mountain House. Everything that they had was what they brought with them. And they left Fairbanks by dog team and arrived in Enana, and they picked up on that expedition was Hudson Stuck, the Archdeacon of the Episcopal Church of Alaska, Harry Karstens, who was then, Stuck was 50 years old, Karstens was 35, who then became the first park superintendent, Robert Tatum, 21 years old, he was a theology student, and Walter Harper, who was 20. And then for those that get their name in history for summiting, it takes people in the rear with the gear to make it happen. And that was Johnny, Fred, and Elias George. And I just wanted to mention those two young men because they were an integral part in making the summit happen. So with that, they encountered a myriad of obstacles and hard luck. Those of you that have maybe had a chance to read part of the book that we provided with you, it was, you know, they lost all their gear, most of their gear, when they both Karstens and Stuck luck to smoke a pipe, and somebody knocked their ashes out and it went to the wrong place and started a fire and burned up their gear, right? And they're not going to call Talkeetna Air Service and get a 185 to bring another load of gear, right? But they made it with what they had. And Karstens and Stuck both concluded in that book, if it hadn't have been for Walter Harper, they would have never summited. It was that tough at the end. So another little known fact is, in those of you that live in Juneau, I know you know this. Walter, he had became ill with typhoid fever, and he was in the hospital in Fort Yukon, the Episcopal Hospital, and he met a nurse from back on the East Coast, and they fell in love and were married. He was going back to become a doctor, going to medical school to come back and practice in Fort Yukon and in the interior. And we all know the story. Their future came to an end on the Princess Sophia when it went on the rocks, and they all perished, and they are buried here at the Evergreen Cemetery here in Juneau. And so that's a thumbnail sketch overview, and if there's not any questions from committee members at this time, Mr. Peterson's ready to go into any more detail, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from the committee on that overview? I also want to note Representative Shaw joined us at 3:05 p.m. Mr. Peterson, any further comment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Bishop. I'll run through and give you guys an explanation of why Senate Bill 144 is in front of you and why Senator Bishop feels strongly that this gentleman should be recognized with a special day in Alaska statutes. I apologize in advance for any of my testimony that is repetitive of what Senator Bishop already said. But Walter Harper's name is permanently stamped in Alaska history because he was the first person to reach the summit of Denali on June 7, 1913. Senate Bill 144 proposes to honor this great Alaskan by designating June 7th of each year as Walter Harper Day. There were six people on the expedition team. Like Senator Bishop said, none of these men had technical climbing experience or technical gear. They'd never climbed a mountain like Denali, and so it was quite impressive that they were the first team ever to reach the summit. Prior to 1913, there were 11 unsuccessful attempts to reach the summit. So this was the 12th attempt, and these gentlemen were successful. Hudson Stuck was one of the expedition leaders, along with Harry Karstens. Hudson was 50 years old, the Episcopal Archdeacon from the Yukon. Harry Karstens was 35 years old. He was an accomplished outdoorsman, a miner, a packer, and a guide. He later became the first superintendent of Denali National Park from 1921 to 1928. Robert Tatum, 21 years old, he was a theology student from Knoxville, Tennessee, and he was working at the Episcopal Mission in Tanana when Hudson Stuck invited him to join the expedition. Walter Harper, 20 years old, he was Stuck's protege, and I'll tell you a lot more about him. Johnny Fred and Esaias George were two 17-year-old boys from St. Mark's Episcopal Mission in Nenana. They were selected by Hudson Stuck to accompany the team to base camp, haul supplies, and hunt for food. Neither Johnny nor Esaias would join the rest of the team on the ascent, however. The plan was for Esaias to return to Nenana with one dog team, while Johnny stayed in base camp to watch the gear. Stuck, Karstens, and Harper launched the expedition from St. Matthew's Church in Fairbanks on March 13th. They traveled by dog sled to Nenana, where they met up with the rest of the team, Robert Tatum, Johnny Fred, and Esaias George. On April 11th, they had their base camp set up and started planning their ascent. The team had shuttled 3,000 pounds of equipment and supplies in backpacks and would continue moving a cache of gear, including several cords of firewood, from camp to camp up the mountain. They estimated that in ascending the 20,000-foot peak, the men had actually climbed 60,000 feet altogether. On May 2nd, they had relayed their cache to the midway point of Muldrow Glacier at 10,800 feet when disaster struck, which was the story that Senator Bishop told you about their gear catching on fire. Despite that setback, they continued climbing, and on June 7th, Walter Harper became the first human to set foot on the summit of Denali, with the other three members of the expedition arriving shortly thereafter. Stuck concluded that Walter could have climbed another 10,000 feet based on his condition at the summit. Harry Carstens referred to Walter as fearless, and Stuck attributed a great deal of their success to Walter's exceptional stamina and his ability to always maintain composure, self-composure in the face of any hardship. As extraordinary as this achievement was, it's not the only reason we should celebrate Walter Harper. Born in Tanana in December 1892, Walter was the youngest of eight children. His mother was Jenny Albert, a Koyukon Athabascan, and his father was Arthur Harper, an Irishman who emigrated in 1847. Arthur Harper was a well-known prospector and trader in the Yukon Basin. In fact, because of his widespread prospecting, numerous discoveries, and his prolific letter writing to outsiders about the gold prospects in the Yukon, it won him the recognition as the discoverer of gold in the region, and he was credited with starting the Klondike Gold Rush. Walter never knew his father personally because his parents split up when he was 2 years old. It was Walter's mother, Jenny, who had the greatest impact on his formative years. She raised Walter in the Athabascan traditional way of life, and he spoke the Koyukon Athabascan language. When Walter met Archdeacon Stuck at a fish camp in 1909, he began attending school at the St. Mark's Mission in Nenana. He was 16. Being so impressed with Walter's ability, Stuck hired him the next year when he was 17 years old to be his winter trail guide, riverboat pilot, and interpreter throughout his missionary travels along the Yukon. The Archdeacon tutored Walter, and in the preceding years, Walter seamlessly integrated into his father's Western culture without forfeiting an ounce of his mother's Athabascan heritage. After the Denali expedition in the fall of 1913, Walter traveled outside with Stuck to continue his formal education in Massachusetts, where he attended the Northfield Mount Hermon Preparatory School through 1916. That same year, he returned to Alaska to continue working with Archdeacon Stuck in preparation for college. In 1917, Walter became ill with typhoid fever. While he was recovering in the Fort Yukon Mission Hospital, he fell in love with his nurse, Frances Wells, who devoted herself to his care. On September 1, 1918, they got married in Fort Yukon. 7 weeks later, the newlyweds boarded the Princess Sophia in Skagway, bound for Seattle, with their final destination being Philadelphia, so Walter could attend medical school, after which the couple planned to return to Alaska so Walter could serve his people as a medical missionary. Sadly, their future dreams were never realized because they both died along with the rest of the passengers when the Princess Sophia ran aground in the Lynn Canal on October 25, 1918. After their bodies were recovered, Walter and Frances were buried beside each other in the Evergreen Cemetery here in Juneau. Walter's untimely death denied Alaska the legacy of a respected elder a full life would surely have provided. However, we feel strongly that passing Senate Bill 144 is a fitting tribute to honor this great Alaskan who lived his life with excellence, integrity, and resilience. In fact, Congress saw the wisdom in honoring the accomplishments of Walter Harper. In 2013, Congress passed the Denali National Park Improvement Act that included a bill sponsored by Senator Lisa Murkowski, naming the Talkeetna Ranger Station after Walter Harper. Anyone who intends to climb Denali must first stop at the Walter Harper Ranger Station to get their permit. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions or comments from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Representative Fields.
I just wanted to thank Senator Bishop for the book, which I'm in the process of reading, and appreciate the bill.
Representative Story.
Yes, thank you. And I, too, want to say that one thing that I appreciate about bringing this forward is when you do an act such as this, or name a day, you ensure that our youth and future residents, current residents, know more about the life of this man and a short time, a short-lived life, but very powerful and lots of ways that how he blended both worlds very well. And I think that is a story that Alaskans need to know more of. So I appreciate you bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Story. Thank you, Senator Bishop, Mr. Peterson. It's our intention that the committee will take action on this piece of legislation later this week. We have a second hearing scheduled on Thursday. There's an amendment deadline 5 p.m. the day before, so that's 5 p.m. tomorrow, Wednesday. There'll also be public testimony on Thursday, and then we'll look to the will of the committee. Thank you very much. The second item on today's agenda is House Bill 74. This is the cruise ship monitoring, Ocean Ranger, et cetera, bill. It's the official name. So we had a presentation last Tuesday from the agency, DEC, with the CS, which was adopted. And for collective reference, that's version /S is the committee substitute that was adopted. A marked departure from the initial bill introduced by the governor. Today we have public testimony scheduled. There are four people online, as well as I think possibly some people in the room. I think given the relative quantity, I'm going to take a liberal approach to testimony, and we can pause and allow the committee to ask questions. We can bring forward the agency when there are technical questions about the contents of the CS that DEC has proposed. At that point, we'll set the bill aside for further committee consideration. And I think I'm speaking for myself and Representative Fields. We're interested in continuing to sort of take bites at this legislation, because it's a big one, and bring it back before the committee in the relatively near future. So just to give a sense of what is to come. So at this point, maybe before opening committee testimony or public testimony, does the agency have any comments that they'd like to make, or perhaps respond to any questions that were posed in the previous committee hearing? Sure. Brief at ease. So the commissioner is on his way, and he'll be representing the – here he is, speaking of. Welcome. It's like Santa Claus and Christmas Eve. Welcome, Commissioner Bruni, to State Affairs. We just pulled up House Bill 74. We've got public testimony slated, as has been noticed, but wanted to provide the agency the opportunity to provide any further comment and or address questions that were raised last Tuesday.
Thank you, Chair Kreis Tompkins, Chair Fields, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Bruni. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, and I ran to get here. So I am ill-prepared. I know that I'm happy to entertain questions. I believe we submitted responses to a number of the questions that were raised. I'm happy to discuss them or just field questions from you if you'd like. I'm at your beck and call.
Any questions from the committee? Maybe to start there.
Maybe after public testimony.
Okay. I think we'll maybe circle back to you, and seeing no other questions offhand from the committee, we'll go through public testimony and then maybe bring you back up.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to remain here or?
Whatever's, I feel free to take a seat, because there might be folks in the audience to testify in person. But I'll start online. So I'm going to open public testimony at this point, and we've proliferated to six people online. We'll start with Terry. There you are. City of Kodiak. This works out well with the AML fly-in. Terry Haynes from Kodiak, welcome. Terry, and please present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Tompkins, Kreis Tompkins, Co-Chair Fields. I'm Terry Haynes, City Council member from Kodiak, and very much appreciate the time that the Commissioner and his staff gave to us just a little bit ago from members of the Alaska Municipal League who are interested in this bill. And for the concept that I saw presented looked very promising. The idea of replacing the Ocean Rangers with DEC personnel, if I understand that correctly, who would have more authority, more ability to test, more teeth, essentially, certainly sounds like a winner to me. And I think that given the cost of the contract to the Ocean Rangers, that it certainly would seem to give you some leeway to get quite a bit done there. But I would like to specifically address that component that would set aside some funds for communities who are improving their wastewater treatment. For Kodiak, I know, and since it's the dreaded unfunded EPA mandate, I'm sure we're not the only community who is in this position of having to construct an ultraviolet plant to treat our wastewater as it goes back out. And of course, anything that we use to make our wastewater cleaner is an improvement, and I think something that visitors to our state might appreciate. I think our pristine waters are certainly part of the Alaska brand that keeps people coming here again and again on these cruise ships. And I certainly think that the concept of using some of these funds to help us with these unfunded mandates, you know, I know in Kodiak we're just scraping together the money to build this plant because it's we have to build it. We'll end up being fined terrifically, and I'm sure you guys are very well aware of all that. But to me, it's a really good fit. It serves a need that we're having right now in our communities. It addresses clean water, and I think addresses our brand as Alaska. And I think the cruise ship folks will be happy to know that we are that much cleaner. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Haynes. Any questions from the committee? Thanks very much. Next, we've got Jack Slatt in Petersburg online. Mr. Slatt, I hope I'm getting your last name right. I know your name. Please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Hi. Thank you very much for allowing me to voice up. What's going on?
I thought I had.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're coming through, and you're plus one.
Okay, thanks. Hey, I just learned moments ago that there's more to this bill than I thought there was. I thought it was the elimination of the Ocean Rangers, who are licensed marine engineers, part of the U.S. Merchant Marine, and that was that. If there is actually an effort underway to replace Ocean Rangers with DEC people, then that kind of changes how I view this whole thing. And I'm hoping I don't hurt anyone's feelings here, but I'm hoping there's not any trickery involved. If you lawmakers will see this through to where DEC people come on board the ships and watch them, then that changes everything to me. Anyway, I hold a chief engineer unlimited license in the United States Merchant Marine. I understand well how sewage treatment plants and oily water separator devices work on ships. It's my concern that cruise ship companies who have a poor track record as far as taking care of American waters near coastal, it's my concern that they're just not left to their own devices, because I can tell everyone who's listening, it costs a fair amount of money to operate sewage treatment plants, and it also costs a fair amount of money, includes manpower, and treating bilge water to a level where it's only 15 parts per million of oil or carbon particulates before it goes over the side. So anyway, with all of that said, I would just advise lawmakers, please make sure that if the Ocean Rangers, who are licensed marine engineers with the United States Merchant Marine, if they're kicked off the ships, then absolutely DEC people should be the ones to oversee the operations. That's all I have to say, and I appreciate my ability to be part of this democracy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slatt. Any questions from the committee? Representative Fields.
Mr. Slatt, I'm sorry, I've forgotten. What was your certification? You said you were a marine engineer, or was it something different?
I am a marine engineer, part of the United States Merchant Marine, and I hold a chief engineer's license, unlimited horsepower, which means I can sail on any ship in the U.S. Merchant Marine other than steam. And I've spent 25 years, almost 30, as an engineer. Before that, I was a logger, timber faller, diesel mechanic at a Cat dealership, on and on. So it's not like I'm against people making profits and corporations succeeding. I just want to make sure that our waters are kept safe for the marine environment, for fisheries, you name it.
Yeah, Representative Fields.
Mr. Slatt, thanks, and I mean, I agree with that intent. I guess I'm curious, do you think that the inspectors should be limited to marine engineers, or are there other potential types of licenses or training that might be sufficient to do the inspections that we know marine engineers can conduct?
That's a great question, and I thank you for that. The DEC people may not understand the way that systems work as well as marine engineers. I'd be surprised if they did. However, they will test effluent that's being sent over the side and treated sewage. So they'll be able to look at levels of fecal coliform, chlorine, if chlorine's been part of the treatment process, you know, chlorine levels, that kind of thing. As far as oily water separators, I think that's more up to United States Coast Guard Marine Safety Inspectors. Certainly if it was a seasoned, experienced, knowledgeable, licensed marine engineering officer, he would be on top of that. He'd understand fully, or should, how oily water separators work, how sewage treatment plants work.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Slaff, for your testimony. Moving on, we've got Tim Nellick in Galveston, Texas. Mr. Nellick, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Good afternoon. Can you confirm that I'm being heard?
You're being heard.
Great. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chairman Christ Tompkins, Co-Chairman Fields, honorable members of the State Affairs Committee. I thank you for this opportunity to present testimony to today's session, and I am interested in discussing HB 74. Although I heard it referred to previously as an extravaganza, et cetera, that puzzles me. I'm here to talk about the protection of Alaska's pristine marine environment. Like the previous testifier, Chief Engineer Slatt, I'm a career merchant mariner. My name is Tim Nellick, and I've been serving the state of Alaska as an ocean ranger since 2012. Like Chief Slatt, it's interesting to me that there is now something on the table which might involve DEC staff doing essentially what the ocean rangers have been doing. Be that the case, that's interesting, so long as this work is getting done. And if I may make a slight sidebar, in my experience, I've never found government employees to be able to work as efficiently or as cost-effectively as contractors, be that as it may. In my career, I've operated ships at sea and in coastal waters since 1970, and this includes experience on all descriptions and all types of vessels, most of the world's bodies of water, including Alaska, in positions up to and including chief engineer and master of vessels. So I know how ships operate, like Chief Slatt. I know their impact on the environment. I understand maritime regulatory compliance, and I understand the lack of compliance. I've seen how mariners can purposefully or accidentally operate in contravention to regulations. And I would guarantee that without a rigorous regimen of verification, such as been provided by the rangers embarked on the passenger vessels in Alaskan waters, regulations will be broken, be they contract ocean rangers, as has been the case in the past, or DEC staff. The rigorous regimen is required. We all know that the forms of pollution include wastewater, sewage, oil, oily waste, exhaust gas, scrubber discharge, chemicals from pools and spas and barbershops, spillage of paint, incidental chemicals from crew exterior maintenance, air pollution from the engines and incinerators, garbage, and other forms of pollution. There are no reliable technical means for remotely detecting these types of pollution, particularly when the ship, unlike a stationary industrial site, gets underway, moves out of the view of the scrutiny of shoreside oversight. Where we do have technical devices that have been mandated, and Chief Slatt will be familiar with these, the oily water separator, the oil content monitor, workarounds can be devised and can be rapidly implemented. Simply knowing, perhaps remotely, when valves are open and closed doesn't tell us the whole story. What's flowing through those valves into the waters of Alaska? logbook entries are simply ink on paper. In 2006, the voice of the Alaskan citizenry was heard and the Alaska Ocean Ranger program was initiated. Since that time, the voice of the citizenry has not changed, and the voice of the visitors to Alaska, the passengers, is in harmony with the citizenry. As indicated by the comments I always hear while I'm on board ship as an Ocean Ranger, passengers express complete willingness and enthusiasm to make their small contribution to fund the program. The Rangers are the eyes, ears, and nose of the state of Alaska 24 hours a day. Even our presence on board in and of itself is a deterrent. Self-reporting, as touted as it may be, is likely to substantially decrease when Ocean Rangers not on board. The program's self-funding, it is desired by the electorate, and it's desired by the passengers. Technical means cannot replace the work of the Ocean Ranger. So one might ask, who is against the Ocean Ranger program as it has been implemented since 2006? In my opinion, only a few vested interests, not the Alaskan populace, not the passengers, and not the environment. So in closing, may I thank the committee for the opportunity to testify and participate, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nellick. Questions from the committee, Representative Fields.
Hi, Mr. Nellick. I guess I would just ask the same question. Do you think that the statute, or do you think the statute should continue to require that a marine engineer conduct these inspections, or should it contain additional options for credentials?
Like Chief Slatt, we operate this equipment, and what's important about that is we've come up through our careers whereby the DNA of mariners has changed to what it is now, and our protection of the environment is first and foremost right up there with the seaworthiness of the vessel, the safety of our crew. So we're dialed in. But as we've come along, we've seen how our others may not be on board yet, and there are ways to circumvent the proper operation of a lot of this equipment. I think that qualified marine engineers are certainly what is needed, whether they be the contractors with the Ocean Ranger program as it stands or whomever DEC may want to incorporate into their staff. You kind of need to know how these machines operate and importantly, how they can be circumvented if someone's not dialed into the regulations.
Thank you. And I've got a couple questions, Mr. Nellick. One of the questions we posed in committee last Tuesday is, what is a marine engineer? And I feel pretty sort of ignorant about what is technically encompassed in that title and credential. My primary association with marine engineers is on the ferry system and MEBA, and somebody says marine engineer, I think somebody who keeps big diesels running on big boats. Can you speak to what the scope of expertise of a marine engineer is, so we, the committee, have a sense what we're talking about?
Is that a question for me, Tim Nellick?
It is, yes.
Certainly. So I went a little bit dark for just a moment. Indeed. So marine engineering is a skilled trade. Often it starts with a degree in marine engineering, but not always. OJT can suffice. Essentially, our job is to operate, maintain, and repair all of the machinery that's necessary for a modern vessel to operate. So this can be anything from a large main propulsion diesel engine of tens of thousands of horsepower, or in my day, steam turbines. We also have all the ancillary equipment we have to maintain, which includes everything from HVAC, water production, electrical power generation, and all of this has to be not only operated but maintained and repaired. It's quite a task. If someone's a marine chief engineer or a marine engineer, he has a reason to be proud.
Thank you. So as a follow-up, maybe my sort of lay impression of marine engineering being diesels and sort of just diesels and keeping a boat running, really the scope is sort of any system on board that keeps the boat functional, including wastewater treatment, including HVAC, including all these other systems. Is that an accurate understanding?
Yes, absolutely. And without quibbling, I might be more tempted to use the term ship. We are, as was Chief Slatt, I believe, unlimited horsepower. We serve on ships, anything as small as what we would call a boat, up to a ship of 1,000 feet long or more and close to 100,000 horsepower. So, indeed, we're primarily involved with propulsion, but HVAC, electrical power generation, all of the plumbing, all of the repairs, hydraulics, it's a broad scope of practice.
Thank you. And Representative Fields has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Nellick. I think you and the previous speaker mentioned all these, but could you just quickly list the different waste streams again? So we've got sewage, we've got gray water, you've got oily water in the bilge. Could you just do a quick list of those to make sure I've got them organized in my head?
Yes, Representative Fields, and indeed, you did mention wastewater, which generally we break down into gray water and sewage. But then there, of course, the wastewater streams that originate in the galley, in swimming pools, other areas of the ship. But wastewater of various forms is one of the big concerns that we, of course, have. And no one in Alaska after Exxon Valdez is unaware of the damage that can be caused by the spillage of oil and oily waste. Now, of course, with the new MARPOL Annex, I think it's 7, isn't it, the exhaust gas requirements, so we have to consider air pollution as well with our engine discharges and the exhausts of the incinerators. Pools, spas, barbershops cause waste streams that have to be managed. Incidental waste of the everyday maintenance of the ship, paint, chemicals, cleaning chemicals, all of the garbage from the passengers. So those come to mind immediately, Representative Fields.
Thanks.
And Mr. Nellick, you're the first ocean ranger I've ever spoken with, so this is helpful. Could you, number one clarifying question, are you an active ocean ranger? And then a second question I want to pose is whether you're active or no longer active. Could you walk us through what a typical day, so much as there is a typical day on a vessel, looks like for you?
Is that a question for Tim Nellick? I've gotten a real low volume here. I may go to my handset. Do you know of any reason on your end that I'm barely able to hear you?
It is a question for you. No reason I'm aware of we'd be coming in light, but you're coming in loud and clear.
Oh, good. Okay, and I've got you now, too. Okay, so we perform the duty of being the eyes and ears and nose of the state of Alaska. What does that mean? 24 hours a day, generally speaking, I personally like to maintain an irregular work hours so that I'm able to be alert, be up and about, seeing things that might not occur between 8 and 5. However, then as far as a scheduled part of my daily work, I will meet with ship's crew. Typically, it is what is known as the environmental officer is our key point of contact. We'll get together with the environmental officer, who's a senior officer on board the ship, and basically I like to describe it as making sure everybody's on the same page, making sure that we are properly filling out logbooks, properly operating the various pieces of equipment that need to be in place while we're in the littoral. We'll look and make sure, we'll see what the status of the exhaust gas scrubber is, what the status of the wastewater treatment system is, our advanced wastewater treatment system. We'll make rounds of the engine room and other spaces on the ship where waste streams are generated. So we'll walk through galleys, check the pools, check the barber shops, the spas and so forth, but primarily what we're looking for, the big waste streams are going to be down below in the engine room. Now, sometimes, depending on the operating status of the ship, we may have limited access to the ship. We'll have to circle back. But generally speaking, we'll spend several hours meeting with the environmental officer and other shipboard officers that are immediately involved with the operations concerning wastewater. We'll digest the information, our findings. We will, now this is on a day when there's no incidents. We will consolidate our findings into a report, and we'll process that report and send it off to our team leader, which eventually will get to the Department of Environmental Conservation. Now, that's if there's nothing that comes to our attention that requires special action. If we see signs of a violation or pollution, we are not empowered, of course, as regulators. We're observers, but we'll report those observations, such as discoloration of the water, such as heavy stack emissions. Possibly we have reason to believe that wastewater management is not proper. We might see a valve that we thought would have been open, or maybe we smell or see effluent that causes us some concern. In that case, we go into a slightly different mode whereby we our reports reflect what we have found.
Thank you. And
Then I forgot middle of the night when we have odd hours of water effluent treatment done by the third party analysis company, we may be up in the middle of the night joining the environmental officer and observing the wastewater samplings that occur.
And Mr. Nelk, I'm unfamiliar with those third party evaluators. Could you explain to us what that is and how that figures into wastewater discharge compliance?
Well, I don't want to get off the reservation here because there are others that are more knowledgeable, but I give you my take on it. And I hope it is not improper to mention the name of the analysis company. I believe it's Admiralty, and I won't even try to guess what their contractual relationship is with the department. But suffice to say that there are, if I'm not mistaken, 26, I think, or a large number of parameters that ultimately need to be tested in the ship's wastewater effluent. And that's a little bit beyond our scope. We're not chemists, beyond the Ocean Ranger scope. It's a little bit beyond the scope of the shipboard staff, but chemists who do that kind of thing all the time do perform sampling events, some announced, some unannounced, and we as Ocean Rangers witness those and, to the best of our ability, make sure that everything we see is correct with regard to the techniques used. The chemists are quite good at it, and they know what they're doing, but then, of course, their samples are sent off, and the effluent is checked for a number of characteristics beyond the simple total suspended solids and coliform and the easy tests that are done on board. And I hope that's a fair assessment. Others in this community of interest certainly can speak to that more knowledgeably than I.
Thank you, Mr. Nelk. Representative Thompson.
Thank you. How often do these tests and samplings take place? Is it on a regular basis? If there are week-long crews coming up the Inland Passage, how many times do they actually do the testing and the sampling?
Representative Thompson, I would only be able to offer a bit of a guess. We get a spreadsheet at the beginning of the season. There's a lot of them. It is very common for a sampling event to occur on board every ship that we're on during the summer. They're quite frequent, but I'd hate to hazard a guess. I'd say not exactly weekly, but probably several times a month the ships are going to get a sampling, and that will include some unannounced samplings. And I defer to the department or others on a better number.
Thank you.
Mr. Nelk, I think I've got two more questions. The first is, I've in my mind's eye, always struggled a little bit to envision what Ocean Ranger operations and compliance work looks like, because cruise ships are larger than, in terms of head count on board, most of the communities I represent in my legislative district, notwithstanding Sitka, and the way things are going. Actually, Sitka might get eclipsed by the population of some of these cruise ships. And just the sheer volume of these ships and the amount of systems on board and pipes and one person, I've always wondered how an Ocean Ranger or anybody could be sure that rules are being followed, given that you can only be at one place at a time and you got to sleep at night, and it's just a huge technological object that you're on. Can you speak to that, and what kind of confidence do you have that while everything might look good while you're checking it out, while you're not around or while you're in a different part of the ship or whatever, rules are being abided by and compliance is occurring?
And this is Representative Thompson.
Chris Tompkins.
It's quite a good question, and you're perceptive, because indeed these ships are huge. One person can't be all places at one time at every moment of the day, and so it is a seemingly insurmountable task. But we do the best we can with the ability that we have. Now, we are not inspectors, we're observers. A lot of it, in my estimation, it falls back upon our sort of second sense of being an engineer, kind of knowing when things are right, when things look right, when it appears that sometimes it's whether you feel that your interactions with the crew are forthright. Do you have a hunch that people are being deceptive? And of course, there are times when you walk by equipment and the old techniques of seeing if any paint has been disturbed or if any flanges have been opened up so that piping can be changed. A lot of times it kind of depends on the smell. That's why I included in my comments that we're the nose of Alaska out there, because sometimes when things don't smell right, it's because they're not right. So I often try to keep an irregular schedule. I'll try to be in places where I might not be expected to be up and about, looking over the side of the ship, looking at the stack and so forth. I would be less than forthright to suggest that we would catch every single instance of a bad actor. But I would suggest to you that having us try to make the observations we can, as many as we can, gives us a better chance at it. And again, a lot of it is just kind of gut feel. How does this ship seem to operate? Is it in their DNA to protect the environment? Or we kind of have a lackadaisical attitude. So some of it's kind of seat of the pants. Other times we can tell by what we see with equipment, any disturbed paint on piping, so forth. Then we'll drill down a little bit deeper. Things we see in the water, things we see in the air, and so forth. Hope that was a decent stab at your question, sir.
Yeah, it is. And one question, and then Representative Fields has a question on that front. And to what extent do you feel like there's a sort of cat and mouse dynamic with the ship or staff on board, that you're a high school math teacher monitoring a geometry final and, you know, keeping an eye out for any funny business, versus, you know, what proportion of the time does everything feel sort of forthright, as you put it, and like everybody's a Boy Scout and you're just sort of checking boxes? If that makes sense, do you see a little bit of both? What's the spectrum that you encounter on different ships and different companies?
Well, as you sort of suggest, it is different on different ships and different companies. In my experience, a lot depends on the rapport I establish with the environmental officer, who's a three-stripe officer on board the ships. Over the years, they have, in my estimation, become a little more tuned in to sincere protection of the environment. It seemed as though in the past they were the shipboard officers that had been assigned this duty and normally did other things. But in my mind, when I meet with a dedicated professional environmental officer, often these people have backgrounds, sometimes college-level degrees, if not graduate degrees, in marine sciences. These people generally, in my mind, do not tend to be deceptive or less than forthright. It can always change, and it's like anybody else. I'm not a mind reader. But so there, of course, is a bit of cat and mouse, and there are times when it strikes me that somebody might be hiding a little bit, and that'll spur my interest. Other times I get a sense that the shipboard staff are making a pretty good stab at things and may be on board with the overall goal of protecting the environment.
In short, Mr. Nellick, what you're saying is it's a spectrum. It's a spread.
What? Yes, and I think in my mind it's improving, and I think our scrutiny is part of that. So it's a spectrum. There's not a standard approach. Well, there is a spectrum. You'll see some ships that seem to be doing a better job, or at least trying to do a better job than others, and it's noticeable.
Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the testimony from someone who's actually done this before, and I passed out to colleagues a letter from another ocean ranger who lives in Eagle River just for some other kind of boots-on-the-ground perspective.
Thank you. And I've got one last question, which is you mentioned ocean rangers serve in an observer capacity. What does that interface between the OR program and DEC look like? If you see something, if you notice something, what happens, and what's the content, what's the substance of what you pass off to the agency if, as an ocean ranger, something goes amiss?
I'd have to take a look at my iPad, because there are different reports we fill out for different instances. There are times if we see a spill proper under the definition of a spillage, any discoloration of the water, our report goes immediately to the Department of Environmental Conservation, and I believe it goes directly to the Coast Guard. Most of the time, there is a filter provided by our manager, such that we don't raise the alarm unnecessarily. But again, we simply make observations. There are some observations that are more impactful than others, and those received more prompt attention. Is that fair?
I think so. And last Tuesday, it was presented that there something like six, I forget what the time span was, reports of NOVs, I think was the term used by the agency, maybe in the entirety of the Ocean Ranger program. Any common sense reaction to that statistic is, oh, that's very, very low number. I'm interested in, from your professional perspective, is that total of six NOVs in the entirety of the Ocean Ranger program representative of a high level of compliance?
No, sir. That would not be my interpretation. And other colleagues of mine may be able to speak to this a little more exhaustively than I am, but let me say this. The NOV process is not initiated by the Ocean Rangers. We make our observations, and whether or not they are then processed as NOVs is out of our hands. I'll defer if any of my colleagues are listening in or are going to give testimony, but I believe it's misleading to say that because there were few NOVs, the Ocean Rangers either aren't doing much or there aren't many violations. I believe that it's more accurate to take into consideration the process by which an NOV is generated, because I know that some of us become frustrated when findings that we do make seem to result in no action by the department. The ice is a little thin for me here. And I'll see if maybe some others can give you some additional background on it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Nellick. That I think greatly broadens my understanding of the Ocean Ranger program. And I don't see any other questions from the committee, so we're going to truck on. But please feel free to stay online, and if we have sort of boots on the ground questions about the Ocean Ranger program, would love to circle back to you for further questions. Next online, Gershon Cohen and Haynes. Mr. Cohen, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gershon Cohen. I'm calling in from Haynes. My involvement with the industry and in the capacity of wastewater discharges and violations goes back about 20 years. I was appointed to the Commercial Passenger Vessel Environmental Compliance Task Force back in 2000 or 2001. After it became known, widely known, that there had been widespread felony convictions throughout the industry in six jurisdictions, at least in the United States, including in Alaska. I worked with that committee for about 5 years, and unfortunately, we were not able to get DEC to actually pass any regulations of note to control discharges, and so that's why we drafted and eventually passed the ballot measure in 2006. I was one of the authors of that ballot measure that created the Ocean Ranger program. My first and really overarching comment here, Mr. Chairman, is that the bill, as I read it, hopes for oversight versus requires oversight. And this kind of speaks to a comment by an earlier testifier that they're wondering or hoping that DEC staff is going to take over for what the Ocean Rangers are now doing. I want to be very clear that in my reading of this, that's not the case. Currently, statute requires Ocean Rangers on board and requires them to perform certain duties. The bill that we have in front of us would give DEC, would repeal the Ocean Ranger program in its entirety, number one. And number two, it says that the department can adopt regulations that may or may not result in inspections, say, while underway by department staff or independent contractors. In 465C, it specifically says that including while underway, the department or an independent contractor retained by the department may inspect systems. Well, that means they may not, and that's a very different world from requiring inspections by having someone on board in statute. Again, we were unable to get the DEC for years to adopt regulations that were going to have any meaningful impact on what was going on with the industry. I think it's important also to note that the commissioner, Commissioner Bruni, has made statements that he feels, and forgive me if I'm not quoting but paraphrasing, but I believe the terms he used were that he felt that the Ocean Rangers program was unnecessary and unfair. Unfair in the sense that we don't observe other dischargers in the way that we are observing the cruise ships, and unnecessary because of the low number of NOVs that have occurred over the last 12 years that was just spoken about by the last testifier. And I would respond to those comments by that perspective by saying that, first of all, there is a world of difference between a land-based discharger and a marine discharger. A land-based discharger is there. They're locked. You can go there any time. A person from DEC can show up on any day and see what's going on. And their discharge itself is fixed. So you can do an analysis of background conditions and see what change is happening over time in that particular area where they happen to be discharging. A marine-based discharge is a completely different situation, especially when you have 30-some ships going up and down the Inside Passage over the course of the summer. They're discharging in the same waters, sometimes multiple ships discharging in the same day. And so it's just a completely different animal than saying that, than comparing it to land-based discharges, and that's one of the reasons the Ocean Rangers need to be on board. It also, his comments also seem to me to ignore the history of felony convictions. I am not aware that any other industry operating in the state of Alaska has the history of felony convictions that the cruise ship industry has for purposefully dumping pollutants overboard to contaminate public waters. And with respect to the reduced NOVs that was just recently brought up, I believe the gentleman who just spoke is correct that while there were only six NOVs over the course of the program, I guess 11 or 12 years, my understanding is that there have been somewhere over 300 incident reports that were referred to DEC that did not become notices of violations. I'd also like to go back and speak for a moment in support of what an earlier testifier said about the electronic monitoring. You know, electronic monitoring can help in some ways. I mean, it does tell you when a valve is opening. It can tell you in real time, you know, either sending a signal to the Coast Guard and or DEC that a valve is opened, what system it's on, what ship it is on. You can then go back and know maybe how, you know, given how long it's open, how much volume of a discharge occurred. But it doesn't tell you if there was a hacking of that piece of equipment so that the equipment was not functioning properly. It doesn't tell you if the equipment was being bypassed. And if that sounds like a harsh position, the fact is that repeatedly the industry, members of the industry, have bypassed pollution control equipment to do exactly that, to be able to discharge things that they weren't supposed to be discharging. And then, in fact, falsifying logbooks and giving false logbooks to the Coast Guard. And it happened 20 years ago, and more than 20 years ago, and it happened just a few years ago. I believe the convictions of Princess ships on the Atlantic were back in 2016, where the exact same thing occurred. There was a bypassing of oil bilge water separators that was purposeful, and then a falsifying of logbooks to the Coast Guard, reporting to the Coast Guard. So all of these things speak to why we need the Rangers on board. There's nothing like having a cop on the beat, and I think that the Rangers, you know, in addition to all of the duties that they fulfill in terms of being marine engineers and, as you say, looking after the diesel equipment and all of the other equipment that's on board, one of the other things that I think is really important to consider right now, unfortunately, very timely, is that the Ocean Rangers are also responsible for a broader set of public health related observations. And given what's going on with the viruses, the coronavirus that's, you know, plaguing the one ship that's been in Japan, and then we found out just the other day that the ship that was sent to Cambodia, in fact, that we thought was not contaminated with coronavirus was. Given that, I think it's really important that we have an Ocean Ranger there who's, in addition to the other duties, is monitoring what's going on in the infirmary on these ships. And that's certainly not something that's going to be covered by electronic monitoring of a valve that may or may not be opened at any given moment. It's critical that Alaska knows that our ports of call and our state agencies know what's going on in those ships in terms of how many people are suffering from respiratory illnesses and what the ship is doing about them. So the Ocean Rangers perform many, many duties that I think, you know, certainly cannot be replaced by electronic monitoring, which, of course, is not required even in this bill. I've heard people say, I believe it was in the last time the bill was being heard, there was testimony that, well, you know, if it was replaced by electronic monitoring, that would be okay. But in fact, the bill does not require electronic monitoring systems to be put in place. It simply says that the fee will be reduced if a ship installs electronic monitoring systems. So the entire monitoring reporting system here that we've known would be scrapped because the bill explicitly repeals 476, it's Section 14, the Ocean Ranger program, and it replaces it with a hope that DEC is going to adopt meaningful regulations. And as also was stated earlier, I don't believe the public has changed its opinion on this matter. And given that the Ocean Ranger program is being paid for by the fees of the passengers and not costing the state, I just don't understand why we would not want this program to continue. And if I might make one other comment.
And briefly, Mr. Cohen, if you can.
One other comment would be that someone mentioned, I believe the fellow from Kodiak was talking about the improvement of shoreside facilities, and certainly that is not my area of expertise in terms of funding and financial issues, but I would be surprised if the tonnage clause would allow that to happen. Juno certainly experienced problems with that legally last year. Anyway, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to speak.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions from the committee? Representative Fields?
Thanks, Mr. Cohen. Issue we haven't covered yet. What's your take on eliminating or keeping in the opportunity for citizen suits as sort of an accountability measure?
Oh, I would also, I don't understand why that measure would be, why it's even being suggested to be removed. There have been no citizen suits filed in the, you know, since the program started. But that's an opportunity for us and members of the public to hold not just the ships but the agencies accountable. And I personally am a strong supporter of citizen suit provisions. It comes out of the Clean Water Act, and I would not like to see that struck from the law.
Thanks.
Seeing no other questions, next online, Chris Schneider in Anchorage. Mr. Schneider, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Yeah, hi, my name is Chris Schneider. The Ocean Ranger for 8 years. Really appreciate you guys taking the testimony. I wanted to hit on a couple things. First, I think the cruise industry is like really good for Alaska as a whole. 8 years, you as an Ocean Ranger hear a lot of passengers. You overhear them talking about, oh, this is amazing. You know, they're so happy. And so as a lifelong Alaskan, that's something that always made me happy. Now, having said that, obviously, ships are made up of people. You might have 1,000 to 1,500 employees, you know, and we're all human. You know, we can make mistakes. We can get in a hurry. We can take shortcuts. And so I think having the Ocean Rangers on board has always been a very good deterrent and a way to keep the priorities where they should be. You know, ships are really kind of organized chaos a little bit. So that's kind of one point. I think if you just take us all off or take Ocean Rangers off, I don't think it'd be beneficial as far as, you know, protecting the environment and all that. The second thing is, I really don't think there's been enough transparency about the program. You know, I think in the first 7 years I did it, anyone in Anchorage I talked to, they didn't know anything about it. They only knew what I told them. And then after everything last year, they knew a lot about what the governor or the commissioner told them. And, you know, I heard someone the other day said all we did was look at sneeze guards and salons. And I thought that was funny because that's not how I remember the last 8 years. Maybe I have amnesia. But I think it'd be better if some of the reports were made public and there'd be some transparency. You know, if you're going to take away a program that was voted in, I think it'd be good if the, you know, citizens of Alaska could kind of see the product of what they voted in before it was just taken away like that. So those were the two major points I wanted to hit. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Fields.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Schneider. Similar question that I asked before. Do you think marine engineers is the right qualification for people doing these inspections?
Yeah, I think that's a really easy way to do it. You could get other people, but it does take a long time to learn how to, like, look at a piping and instrument diagram and figure out what's going on. So just having marine, and it takes even longer to, like, know what happens if this valve is closed, you know, just from reading a diagram. And as Tim stated, you know, it's really operating the equipment and working for many years. I think it's definitely the easy way to make sure people can do the job. So if you're bringing in people who don't have that background, it really is difficult to get them kind of where they just know it off the top of their head like that.
Follow up. Based on your experience, Mr. Schneider, what percentage of sailings do you think should have an onboard an inspector, whether it's an Ocean Ranger or a DEC employee?
You know, the more the better, honestly. But I do think it's been a really effective deterrent. I do think if you wanted to, I think just going all DEC route would not be the best, because I think, too, if they're saying, oh, we're going to travel to the ship, you're going to find out real quick. It's really hard to travel in Southeast Alaska, even in the summer. You can miss a flight. I mean, I got stuck in Juneau once, and the ship left, you know, and then I had to go meet it somewhere else. I think if you wanted to reduce coverage a little bit and add some people at DEC, I think that might actually be a good idea. I really think it's good that you guys are looking at this so closely. Like I said, it really hasn't gotten a lot of attention. The other thing is, yeah, I've really thought about, like, what difference, what level of assurance. It's really hard to know if you're making a difference, but when the most illuminating thing to me was when Carnival had the whole Department of Justice thing. Part of the settlement was they have a court-appointed monitor, and they have these teams of auditors that fly out. And, I mean, you have, like, four of them. I was on a ship once where four guys fly in, and everyone has to drop what they're doing and do what the monitors want. They're actually the auditors. They work for the monitors. And they make their reports public, and there has not been – they've not found anything in Alaska. And they find stuff everywhere, and it really seems like the last report had the word Alaska in it once, if you did a, you know, a Control-F search. And it actually just said the ship was on its way to Glacier Bay. I don't even think it was in Alaska when they were using the wrong fuel, I guess. And that's something that's actually really easy to tell by looking at the stack, as you can see, if they're using the cheaper fuel or the more expensive fuel.
Thanks.
Further questions for Mr. Schneider? Thank you for taking the time to testify. We've got two other folks online, Robert Lako in Vancouver, Washington. Mr. Lako, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Hi, this is Robert Lako. I'm a marine engineer. I got 20 years as an engineer, 40 years in the industry as a whole. In fact, my first ship to, when I started out on license, was to Alaska on a container ship, and I went full circle. I've been up there for the last 8 years as an ocean ranger, making sure that the cruise ships were doing what they said they were doing and protecting the environment, which, like Tim and Chris and people have been saying, I don't think if we weren't on board, that you would have a lot more incidents, and a lot of them would go unseen until it was too late. Because what I do, as I do the same thing as Tim, I meet with the environmental officers, and I got a good rapport with most of them. Some of them don't like us, but that's their prerogative. We're basically auditors checking out what they're doing. And, you know, they give us time to go around the ship and look at all the different waste streams. And Tim failed to mention the food waste, which is a big, big, big item right now. Last season for me, there were ships that were, they pulp the food waste and store it in pulp and big tanks until they get outside. Well, there's something close enough, 3 miles or whatever, and they discharge it. But sometimes we'll open those tanks and we'll look in. Well, a lot of times we've opened them and looked in, and there's straws and plastic and stuff that gets mixed in with the food waste. And, you know, if we weren't there checking that, that stuff would be just getting discharged into the waters, and eventually it's going to make it ashore somewhere up there. So that's one thing that's a real, it's not just wastewater, it's food waste, it's scrubber waste from the open loop scrubber systems. We see the black soot in the water, we report it as hazardous. It's up to the DEC, like Tim said, to, you know, levy the fines or do whatever they do, but I've seen a lot of that, and if we weren't on those ships, I know what they're going to do. They're just going to do what they want to do, and I don't think the DEC is going to be able to monitor them, you know, catch it. If they're just going to go down and visit the ship in port, well, they're going to all be on their best behavior, and they're not going to do anything wrong, or so to speak. But the program I know is working, and just us being there, I feel confident and I feel good about what I've done in the last 8 years up there. So if you try to get some people on there with no experience, like I said, I've got 40 years in the marine industry, and I've been sailing chief engineer, first engineer, any unlicensed rating. I've had sailed almost everything, and a lot of the time in Alaska with the tankers and the container ships up there, the Tote and the Horizon. But if you try to change the program, the ships are only getting bigger. They're only getting more people, more impact. I was on three ships last year with 6,000 plus people, and there's a big impact. And if people can't see that, they really don't see it. So I just want to say, I think if you try to change a program that's working, you say you don't have any notice of violations. Well, that's because we're there making sure they're not violating. There was some incident in Glacier Bay last year or 2 years ago where some wastewater got discharged, which there wasn't a ranger on the ship, and you could put all the monitoring you want on valves, and you're not going to find it. This was an incident where they were using ballast tanks for holding the wastewater, and they put it in the wrong tank that was already full, and it overflowed into the Glacier Bay, and I don't think you guys want that up there. But my take is that you eliminate the program, you're going to have a lot more problems. And I don't know if you got people that think they know they can watch them, but the cruise ship, there's a lot of people on those ships now. And with the viruses, like the gentleman said earlier, we watch for in the galleys, and we watch in the food lines and the sanitation practices. It's not just, I walk around the ship all day long, and anytime you see something, a potential hazard or anything, I make a note of it. I either put it in my report or I bring it to the attention to the ship, and a lot of times I'll be right on it. And another pollutant that I found a lot up there is the painting. Those ships are nice and white and clean for one reason. They're painting all the time, and they have to do it in Alaska, but they have procedures, and a lot of times they get complacent, and they start chipping and painting without the containments, and this stuff's going right in the water. And I know you guys don't want that up there, so that's all I have to say about it. If anyone has any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Lako. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, final person in queue, Jeff Hockenin in Anchorage. Mr. Hockenin, if I got your pronunciation right, please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Hello, my name is Jeff Hockenin. I'm representing myself. Thank you, Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to address this issue. I'm one of the 8 Alaskans that worked in the program last year. I previously have given written and public testimony supporting the Alaska Ocean Ranger Program. Last week, I provided a written statement to SB 70 to the Senate Resource Committee. There's plenty of testimony in favor of the Ocean Ranger Program and the benefits it has produced. I encourage you all to read and study those facts. One aspect of the program that has not been mentioned much is about the jobs it has created. I'd like to share some of what the program has done for me and my family. When I voted yes for ballot measure 2 in 2006, I knew there was a potential of employment as an ocean ranger. I've been working in Alaska in the maritime industry since 1981. In 2008, I was hired as the first Alaskan in the program and have continued working as an ocean ranger until it was canceled last year. The program provided a nice income for me and my family. The $4 head tax on the cruise ship passengers is the proverbial golden goose. It costs the citizens of Alaska nothing to fund the program, pays back rewards in ensuring Alaska remains a pristine place and tourists want to visit, and opportunities. And I'm reading from my statement here. Opportunities make a nice living. In 2015, with some of the money earned from my job as an ocean ranger, I purchased a new truck from a car dealership in Anchorage. That money paid the salesperson a wage and commission. I can only speculate that he took that money and probably spent it on something else in Anchorage. The people that got his money then again probably spent it on something else in Alaska. My point is that the golden goose is feeding many people in many ways. The governor and the commission Bruni want to rob that nest. The governor wants to repeal the program that I and many other Alaskans voted for. Don't be fooled by all the reasons that the commissioner gives for repealing the program. In my opinion, he wants the golden goose laying exclusively for the growing of government. So I ask you to question the commissioner, find the facts, and follow the money. I think the more beneficial to keep the program as it was voted for, and producing jobs, protecting the safety of the passengers and the environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hockenin. And I don't believe we've received your testimony. So if you have something in writing, please send to hsta@akledge.gov. And we on the House side can add that to the public record. Any questions? Representative Fields.
Mr. Hokanen, are you a marine engineer as well?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thanks.
Further questions?
I'd like to just add one little thing that I've, since there is more time, usually these have got a time limit in which you can speak. But I am
being liberal in testing anybody. If you have a short comment, please add it, and then we're gonna move on.
Okay, there's a term that we use in our industry. It's called near misses, and near misses are situations that can usually you can see something can be rectified real quick. I'd like to share a little thing where in Skagway where you see the cherry picker is going and they're using it to paint and everything. Several occasions there I've seen where people have been walking under the cherry picker and made mention to that to the environmental officer or something, and those situations are usually rectified real quick. So what I'm trying to show is there's many times that the Ocean Ranger's eyes on the ship are solving these or hitting these near misses, which could probably potentially cause other problems down the way or serious injury. So we're there and we're eyes that can help in many ways.
Thanks for that comment, and seeing no other questions from the committee. I'm going to put out a call to anybody in the room who's here to testify on House Bill 74. Whatever order suits the two of you, please come on forward. Oh, nope, you're good. You're good. Yeah, come on in. Please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is John Clifton Passmore, and I'm representing myself. I'm a resident of Eagle River, a U.S. Coast Guard licensed master mariner, and an ocean ranger. I watched this committee's previous hearing on HB 74, and I would like to make a few comments. First of all, there are a few good ideas in the bill. Requiring the cruise lines to submit data in approved format should save the state time and money and is in line with requirements for other monitoring programs. Random inspections may also be a way to improve the program, although, as I have explained in my written testimony, the devil will be in the details. When voters, including myself, passed the ballot initiative in 2006 establishing the Ocean Ranger Program, it was our intent that the funds collected for the Ocean Ranger Program be used for onboard monitoring by licensed engineers or equivalently qualified individuals. Marine engineers are senior level vessel personnel, ship's officers, that meet national and international standards for training and competency. Licensed engineers, together with licensed deck officers, are the men and women who operate the vessels. We are more than qualified to monitor cruise vessels. The U.S. Coast Guard has determined that we are qualified to be legally responsible to operate large vessels and follow all applicable laws, including environmental laws. Most of us have unlimited tonnage licenses, in other words, any vessel, any tonnage, any waters, and many ocean rangers are licensed chief engineers, which is the highest engineering rating. Two of us are master mariners and could take command of any vessel, including cruise ships. We are the experts on operating large vessels, and this is the reason ocean rangers are required to be licensed engineers or equivalent. Upgrading sewage treatment facilities in ports visited by cruise ships is a good idea, but diverting funds from the ocean program is not the most appropriate source. More appropriate sources include revenue collected from cruise ships that is not designated for the Ocean Ranger program. Princess Cruise Line and its parent company, Carnival, are on probation for environmental violations and were found in violation of conditions of probation in June 2019 and fined $20 million. My written testimony includes a link to the court-appointed monitor's report from December of 2019 showing a culture and pattern of repeated violations of environmental laws, including using heavy fuel near Glacier Bay last August. If there is any doubt that some cruise lines are not capable of policing themselves and cannot be trusted to do the right thing, a few minutes of review of this document will remove any doubt. Now is not the time to remove monitoring requirements from convicted felons that repeatedly violate conditions of probation and allow them to police themselves, which is exactly what House Bill 74 proposes to do.
Thank you for your testimony, and I see that's written testimony. If you wouldn't mind, when you're done, share it with the committee staff so we can put it on record. Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Passmore. Could you just talk about this NOV issue, when you notice something, report it, I guess, to the department, does or doesn't become an NOV? Could you just explain that?
Yes. As my colleague Tim explained, with the exception of a spill, which is obviously an emergency that needs to be addressed right now, we let the vessel know and then we send it off to our company, who will send it on to DEC, and then from there it's their decision of whether they want to turn it into an NOV or not. And speaking from experience, I've sent a few things that were kind of minor, like we had paint chips going in the water, which is, you know, not supposed to happen technically an NOV if they wanted to. I understand why they wouldn't want to, but things like that, we report lots of things like that that don't make it to the point of, I mean, do you want to give a significant fine for something like that, or do you just want them to fix it? And so that's beyond my, I guess, beyond my pay grade, is the saying.
On that subject, have you or colleagues in the Ocean Ranger program reported violations that are more than paint chips in the water that you think constitute a harm to clean water that haven't manifested in an NOV?
I believe so, but I'm hearing them secondhand, so I would have to, you know, we all work in separate places, so I would hate to say for sure, but.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please excuse my lack of voice, but you mentioned that most of the engineers have the capacity to take command of any vessel. Is that accurate?
Not. You have to be a captain to take. You have to be a captain to take command. So no, but they can be responsible for all the machinery and all the equipment on the vessel. Yeah, so they're responsible for all the pollution relating to it as well.
So is there any time that an Ocean Ranger would need to take that authority?
No, but we have the same licenses that the guys that are operating the vessels do, so we understand what they do.
Follow up?
No, that was it. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. Thanks for coming and giving your testimony today. Totally unrelated committee, there was a mention that there's another person had an offhanded comment where this program puts a bunch of college kids out of letting them recruit around on cruise ships for the summer. And obviously you're not a college kid, but can you talk to, you could be, I'm sorry, yes. Thank you, Representative Vance. We have many non-traditional students, especially at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Can you talk about what the if there is an internship program or how that works? And we heard from a number of other Ocean Rangers today, but just talk about the qualifications that you do need to be an Ocean Ranger, and if there is an internship program or something that might fulfill that offhanded comment.
There is not. The process of getting a marine engineer's license or a deck license is generally a 4-year degree through an academy and then a series of tests. And from there, moving your license up, a lot of the guys are chief engineers, and that would be another 1,060 days plus testing, plus classes on top of that. So it's there are some very experienced folks out there.
Thank you.
Where did you say you're from?
Eagle River.
And you flew down for today's hearing?
Yes, I did.
Well, that's impressive. Thank you for taking the time and spending the money. I kind of went all out with my curiosity with Mr. Nellick, not realizing there'd be four other Ocean Rangers testifying in succession. But I guess just to take advantage of the fact that you're here, I mean, what's been your personal experience when you're on board on the sort of cat and mouse versus Boy Scout spectrum question I posed to Mr. Nellick?
I've seen less of the cat and mouse and more of either apathy or people just don't know. We had a discharge of spa water, and it was just because somebody was just had been on the vessel a couple days and didn't know any better. And the paint chips that I was talking about, that was apathy. The guys had the containment there. They just hadn't moved it, so they had moved down another 10 feet, and it was, you know, the containment was 10 feet over, and it was going straight into the water. So I haven't seen that cat and mouse. Not saying it doesn't occur, but it's been more of a, yeah, not the cat and mouse.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm trying to think of how to, I would
love more conversation, but I'm trying to think of how I can ask you, because you commented how there are things in this bill that you do like. The element of surprise visits, you know, would be a positive note, among other things. But I guess what I'm aiming for here is that a hybrid model, if you will, because I'm seeing a lot of positives in this bill, and I'm getting to my question. On the fiscal note, it has the intent and the request for two new environmental program specialist positions and two engineers. So while the term Ocean Ranger program would be going away, DEC would still be hiring the marine engineers, but this time whoever the lucky draw would be out of those of you who have already served, you're obviously the ones qualified, you would now have authority of the DEC to make to do something immediately versus having to send it through your company to DC, waiting for them to check your logbooks, to send something back. Wouldn't that be utilizing the expertise that the marine engineers have in a greater capacity for Alaskans?
Possibly, but from what I've seen of the numbers is we will not have a shipboard presence very rarely, if at all, and I believe we need to be present on the vessels.
Follow-up. This talks about approximately 45 in-state trips would be required for inspectors. That would be a minimum that is recommended. I don't know if this is if you had been able to see the fiscal note, but that's why I said that I'm seeing positives and am hoping that that's communicated, is that we weren't doing away with marine engineers and the expertise that you bring, but trying to give you more authority to act immediately under DEC. And that to me is a win, because we're cutting out the middleman. And if you're on board with all of this knowledge and expertise as an engineer, but you don't have authority except to put in the logbook, you know, I would want to utilize what you've all of the people who have testified utilize you for the maximum impact, to be able to, you know, police our waters.
Yeah. So, what's the question? I guess I'm sorry. I agree. I agree with your points, but I'm not sure what the question was.
I guess what I'm putting to the committee is that that we look for what. We look for the happy medium of, and not being afraid that change is bad. It's a different name. You are marine engineers, but you wouldn't have the title Ocean Ranger anymore under this bill. And I think that's a lot of the angst that is being felt, is that it seems like something is completely being lost. And I'm seeing that perhaps it's different, but hopefully we're gaining. I want to gain out of this, and obviously we need to have more conversation about what that looks like exactly, the lenience that we want to give in regulation, and what exactly we want to
Thanks, put Representative. Yes, yeah, excellent comment. I know Zach has a question too, and I'm just going to do some time budgeting on the record here. This committee adjourns at 5 o'clock. It's my intent to adjourn by 5 o'clock. We have one other bill on the agenda. I want to allow that bill 15 minutes or so. It's going to be a brief first hearing. There's one other public testifier. We've also have the Marine Exchange available for questions. And in the event that there are questions, I want to provide that opportunity. So working in reverse, we've got a little less than 10 minutes on this bill. Representative Fields, you have a question.
Yes, and thanks to my colleague for her comments. I agree on that goal. Just wanted to ask, in your experience, how many Ocean Rangers are actually out on the water doing inspections at any given time during the summer, ballpark?
I would say around 15.
Okay.
We have schedules. We could look that up if you want a firm
that's
number.
That's great. Thanks.
Okay.
And what is the company that contracts to do the Ocean Ranger program?
Crowley.
Okay. Seeing No further questions from the committee. Mr. Passmore, thank you for testifying. Thank you for flying to Juneau to testify.
Thank you for having me.
And our final public testifier. Welcome. Please put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Joe Geldhoff. I live in West Juneau, and I'm pleased to briefly testify here. I, for various reasons, was one of the principal authors of the Cruise Ship Initiative, which was written in 2003 following a very unsatisfactory special session in, I think, 2001. Prior to that, I was I was an assistant attorney general, and I was also on contract to the Alaska State Senate to deal with cruise ship issues, particularly cruise ship revenue issues. My personal background includes a lot of work with the Military Sealift Command, the United States Merchant Marine in various capacities. I work sometimes with Alaska Tanker, and I have something more than nodding familiarity with large vessels, even though I am not a licensed Marine officer, either deck or engineering. I'm a lawyer and do a lot of work to facilitate movement of bombs and tanks and oil around the world on the U.S. flagships. The large passenger vessels sailing in Alaska present a significant regulatory challenge in terms of protecting our marine waters. The vessels are mobile. There's upwards of 1.5 million passengers sail on these vessels now. It's a dynamic industry. It's a capital-intensive and labor-intensive industry. And they make a lot of money and provide a lot of good opportunities for Alaskans and visitors to our thing. I am not here to try to throttle the large passenger industry. They've been good to Alaska, but they have real problems with their marine and air discharges. This particular bill you're looking at focuses more on the marine discharge, and it's a serious issue. In addition to the passengers, there's upwards of 400,000 crew. So, you know, that is a big slug of waste stream in. It's not just the passengers. The Department of Environmental Conservation has a fairly casual attitude or record in dealing with this, and it pre-exists the current commissioner. It goes back before, even back to the Knowles administration. And that is why, as much as anything else, the citizens got together in 2006 and passed this measure. And by the way, this was not some nefarious environmental plot or funded by outside people. The leading proponents of the Ocean Ranger program and the onboard monitoring came from the fishing fleet in Alaska, who are regulated in the federal fisheries, and mostly Native women who were looking at these increasingly large vessels sail in front of places like Angoon and stuff and saying, where is all that stuff going from? Is it going into our waters where we fish, where we clam, et cetera, et cetera? I believe there's room for improvement of the existing regime, and I am not one to foreclose doing some electronic monitoring, both to save money and to give in real time data to the regulating industry, whether it's by contract or directly to DEC. But, you know, the program that's worked since 2006, where you have an onboard observer, is a vital part of enforcing our water quality standards. If the Commissioner of Public Safety was sitting here on a bill that said, you know, we're going to do away with troopers, and we're just going to have a few probation officers kind of check things out occasionally, I think you'd be surprised. And you know, Commissioner Bruni, I'll see, he's a nicer guy than I am. I mean, and I'm not accusing him of anything nefarious here. But, you know, he came into office and wanted to eliminate this program. And there's been some modifications in it here. But what you need to do on behalf of our citizens and our water here, in order to protect our marine waters, is to take what the department has given you and make it the best possible bill you can. And you can do that by calling for some limited monitoring. You may be able to have some video monitoring of the electronic monitoring. There's some broadband issues there, and there's some maybe technical legal issues that arise from the Intertanko thing about requiring hardware on there. There's supposedly an AG's opinion, I don't think it's in writing, that says, oh, we can't demand electronic monitoring. And the Intertanko thing was the state of Washington said, we want double-hull tankers, and they were really forcing changes to vessels. I think there's a nuanced approach towards the state of Alaska saying, we want data and we will incentivize or even pay for the electronic monitoring devices. But DEC and or the contractor, that is you, on behalf of all our citizens, we need to see what valves are open, when they're open, so that at the very least you can say, did you know your valve was open? They go, oop, bad, close it. Oop, that's the sixth time this week that you've been, you know, an open valve here. You know, when you get back to port, the written NOV here will be waiting for you. But we can use modern technology to improve our technology, to improve our enforcement and the protection of our waters. You need to keep at least some ocean rangers, and there's discretion for the department for the, I'll say, naughtiest operators need to say, you know what, you have a repeated pattern of abuse here. For this summer, you're going to have a ranger on most of the ships all the time. No police force has 100% coverage, but there is going to be a few operators who need the full treatment of having an onboard observer all the time. You need to set the minimum standard that you think is consistent with protecting our waters and the public's resources here in law, and then give the discretion to the department to figure out how to do that. But the bill that's in front of you, the administration's markup, gives way too much discretion, well, not just for my taste, but I think consistent with your duties as an independent branch of government who set the law and require them to administer it. Don't be just saying, yeah, we'll trust you, and you do it by regulations. That is a recipe for disaster. Make sure you provide for occasional no-knock, you know, no-notice inspections. Some of the ocean rangers should be, you know, they don't have to be on 24/7, but they can swing aboard in a place like Juneau right up to Skagway. You know, give DEC firm direction on the kind of a layered monitoring approach, some full, some part-time, some just occasional in port. You should consider amplification of the existing penalties. Read the reports. You know, look at the fines that are being levied. If you don't look at and come up with an evaluation of the value of our marine waters, you're doing the visitors and our citizens, including the people who use it for commercial sport and subsistence, a disservice. I agree that there's a limited role. There's some legal problems with using some of the funds or using a funding source from passengers to improve shoreside. There has to be a strong nexus. So if you're going to put money derived from passengers into improving shoreside facilities to take marine waste in a place like Ketchikan or Kodiak or someplace, there has to be a strong nexus. You can't just create a slush fund from passengers and give it willy-nilly to anybody. There has to be a strong connection. And we alluded to the litigation. I won't go through all that stuff. My recommendation is leave the existing financial framework in place with the $4 per passenger Ocean Ranger fee. Run the program out of that, but leave it in place so that you have accounting every year when you build your budget. To that, I would say for a limited period of time, 10 years is my recommendation, add a $3 surcharge that will allow DEC to use that $3 fee to capitalize improvements to your shoreside facilities in places where there really are discharges onto the shoreside facilities. And you're not going to be able to do it for Fairbanks, but you know, if they really are taking discharges in places like Kodiak, fine. Ketchikan, fine. Give DEC a little bit of capital, put it on for a limited period of time, and sunset it so that they have the money to take matching federal monies and they can build out in the places where we can treat effluent streams in Alaska. And I guess the last comment I'll say is the ocean rangers right now do look at sanitation in addition to gray water and wastewaters and everything. The idea about giving them additional authority to collect data for the state of Alaska, DEC, the Department of Health and Social Services on some of the pathogens, it's probably a good one. I don't have a specific language on that, but you know, the Center for Disease Control monitors influenza viruses through Southeast Alaska because we are a vector a primary. We're one of the first places they often come, often through crew, into Alaska. And so this, you know, we shouldn't get hysterical about the new viruses, the coronaviruses and everything, but the point is well taken that there's a role to explore there. And I think you should talk to the Commissioner of Health and Social Services and the epidemiologist about that. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I tried to compress my comments. If you have one question, I'll try to answer it succinctly.
We'll allow one question and then move on next. Well, thank you, Mr. Geldhoff, for your testimony. Any questions from the committee for Mr. Geldhoff?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You quaffed our curiosity. Okay. I'm going to close public testimony at this time. That was immensely edifying for me. At least I appreciate everybody who took the time to testify, and we'll follow up with the department. I think there's, you know, a number of clarifying questions that we'll be eager to dig into. But at this time, Representative Thompson, your piece of legislation on lotteries. House Bill 239 is up for a first hearing. We also have Mr. Witten, staff to Representative Thompson. Please put yourself on record and present the legislation.
Thank you. I'm Representative Thompson from House District 2, and with me is my staff, Seth Witten. We're here to introduce House Bill 239. I realize we're condensed on time, so we'll try to be very brief. House Bill 239 creates a Alaska State Lottery Board within the Department of Revenue. The bill also authorizes the board to conduct in-state lotteries, draw games, and participation in multi-state lotteries. This bill came about because a couple of years ago, traveling to California, I would go in and buy $5 worth of lottery tickets because on Friday they have a draw and it's a big prize. So we looked at this and I started thinking that, you know, the state of Alaska needs revenue. This could be a revenue stream, so I tasked my staff with doing a lot of research over this last year, and they did a tremendous job. A lot of things we found out. The Department of Revenue estimates that we'll probably bring in net around $5 to $10 million a year off of a in-state and a multi-state lottery. We did a lot of other research. We got contacted by the nonprofit gaming industry in Alaska, that they were concerned that if we went wider than just the draw tickets, that it would affect their ability to raise money with the charitable gaming, pull tabs, and bingos. So we drew into our bill that there would be no scratch-off instant winner tickets or video type games, which seemed to be a problem with gambling addiction when they have that instant gratification of an instant win. We felt that the draw type lottery with a once-a-week draw doesn't attract the addiction of gambling and instant gratification but an instant winner. So we did draw that into the bill to limit that from happening. We've had a lot of different things that we've looked at, and a lot of different states' research done in Wyoming and North Dakota, clear back to Maine on what they have, and brought my staff along to answer any technical questions and let you answer any questions he might be able to answer about the research that we've done. And so we have expert testimony that will be available next Tuesday when we bring the bill back, and I thank the committee for hearing it, and we're ready for questions. And
questions. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative Thompson. Maybe it's a question for Mr. Witten. In some of the other small states like Wisconsin, or not, like Wyoming and North Dakota that you mentioned with a smaller population, how much money is generally raised for that state and given out in those lotteries, and generally how many people apply for them?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, we will have the CEO of the Wyoming Lotto here on Tuesday when the bill comes back up, and I would be more comfortable with Mr. Klontz, Jonathan Klontz, answering those questions.
I'll hold them off for then. Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Story.
Thank you. I wanted to know if you've seen any studies on state lottery impacts to those on lower incomes.
Through the chair, Representative Story, just to be clear, when you're talking about impacts on the individuals with lower incomes? Are you talking about problem gambling in those groups of people?
Sure, that could be one, but just in general, I've heard of impacts on citizens with lower incomes that they spend a lot of their some do, of course, and that leads to addiction. And I know from your comment before that you're going to one time a week versus an instant gratification, I was thinking maybe you came across some information and impacts.
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Story, what I can tell you, and I certainly don't mean to represent myself as an expert, and we've been in touch with experts, and I'm happy to provide some of the psychological research and data that we've been looking at. To that point, one of the things that we've found as we've looked into this is there are three factors that really play into problem gambling and gambling addiction. Those are the event frequency, which is how often you can play and how rapidly, how often you win prizes, and then how quickly you get the reward for those prizes. And those things seem to kind of consistently come up in the psychological research that I've reviewed, and I'll be happy to get some of that together for the committee and submit it as a committee document. In terms of lottery spending, what I can tell you is kind of standard as I understand it, and a number you see a lot, is that the lowest 20% of the population does spend 61% of the entire gross spending on lottery. That gets skewed by the fact that there are these instant win games, there are so many games. Those breakdowns aren't as stark when you get into just the draw games, and we'll also be happy to put together a document for the committee that breaks some of that down.
Mm-hmm. Just follow up.
Follow up.
Yeah, and I certainly know that all levels, people with levels of incomes can have an addiction to gambling. But thank you for those more statistics. And I look forward to any more information that you have.
Further questions from the committee?
I was just going to ask for that. Thank you, through the chair. That modeling of just for the draw, kind of what are the distributional impacts, and is it basically consistent across, you know, income decile or quintile, or is it regressive in nature?
Through the chair, we'll get that information together and submit it to your office.
Thanks.
I'd also like to recognize Representative Josephson, who has joined the committee. We know he's here for state affairs, and the fact that UA set up subcommittees in 6 minutes is a mere coincidence. I think the one question I would have is if maybe in the highest of levels you could explain the differences between your bill and the other lottery bill that's out there that the governor obviously flagged it in the state and has since dropped a bill. What's the quick compare contrast between the two?
In the consideration of time, we will get into that then at our next meeting back on Tuesday so we can explain the differences between the governor's bill and this particular bill.
Okay. Representative Story, maybe a last question for the evening.
Sure. I'd be interested in hearing next week. I know that it's designated perhaps the income could be $5 to $10 million and it would go to the general fund, or have you thought of any designated fund that you would recommend?
We gave it some consideration while putting this bill together, and at one time we were talking about taking a percentage to go into the education. But then we started thinking about the way that the state manages to operate its money. We could raise $5 million for education, and here's the education budget. Well, will it get reduced by $5 million? Because they got $5 million. We wanted to leave it up to the legislature to decide how to use this money.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson, thank you for the bill introduction, and Mr. Witten for the answers. And seeing no further questions at this time, we're going to set aside House Bill 39 for further consideration. Thank you, Martha and Madison, for facilitating today's meeting. And we are meeting again this Thursday, 3 o'clock, same place. And that's February 20th. We're adjourned at 4:56.
Thank you.